happy Friday, and welcome to Minute 55 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and for the final time this week, and probably for this entire season, I'm in Boston, and I'm recording with my wonderful host and guest at the same time. Host and guest, Sean German.
Oh, thank you for having me, and you're very welcome to be a guest, and I'm happy to be a guest as well.
Yes, dual guests. Yes. All right, so minute 55 begins with Al continuing to walk towards the front door of the building, and ends with James giving a report. So yesterday we ended the minute with Al Powell responding to the 911 call after a very long time. Mm-hmm. He finally got to the Nakatomi building. I would think that there would have been maybe a car that was closer by the amount of time that it took him to get here. But, you know, it's a crank call. They don't need to get someone. They're not going to send the real cops in. They're going to send a desk right. jockey on his way home, to check out this little crank call. Come on, how could there be terrorists? Who knows? Terrorists in 1988.
Right.
On Christmas Eve. Don't they have better things to be doing? I don't know. So he showed up. He parked in a very strange way and then got out of there. Well, actually, now we know why he parked that way because, that's the way they needed to do that for the plot.
Right.
The things that happen next week won't happen the way that they should if he didn't park that way.
Right.
So I think that's what it comes down to. Because yesterday, to remind everyone, we discussed about the fact that why did Al park the way that he parked. But, okay, now we know. So he continues walking towards the front door. And as he's walking towards the front door, we get a shot of Eddie, who just got instructions from Hans. We don't know, according to the movie, what the instructions are. But he walks leisurely to the front gate, to the front door, pulls out his swipe card in order to open it. It looks very genuine. It looks like Eddie is doing the job the way that he's supposed to do it.
Right.
There's nothing out of the ordinary here for Al to be a little more suspicious as to what's going on. And then he takes out a code key and, swipes it against the front of the door and is able to open the doors up. He then smiles and looks very friendly and says to Al, good evening, officer. What can I do for you? Which is, a nice and friendly way for him to greet a police officer. And, I would be more suspicious of the fact that he's overly nice.
Yeah.
this is Christmas Eve, so I guess the guard might be a little bored. So maybe he's happy to see another face. Maybe that's how Al can interpret it.
Yeah, he is a little overly friendly. This isn't this isn't a routine visit. This isn't something he was expected. Well, certainly, I guess it doesn't come up. It'll come up later. He talks about the football game. He's got a college football game on the screen that he's watching.
We'll get there in a little while, right?
But shouldn't he be a little bit annoyed that this is pulling him away from the game? He might miss a big play.
That's true. That's a good point. And I love the way that he it's a close up of him.
Yeah.
Showing up. And at this point, then the scene switches and we see Carl, Fritz, and Franco running down the corridor. Now this is the corridor that they came in.
Mm-hmm.
So it might actually be one floor up above the, above the lobby. That actually does make a little more sense.
Yeah.
And they run over to Alexander. Now, I don't know why they would have come to this level. That's a separate issue. What would have... Carl and the other two henchmen, Fritz and Franco, were all the way up on the 30th floor.
Mm-hmm.
And they got pulled away because the police are showing up. And for some reason, they're sending them down to a floor very close to the ground floor, which I'm trying to figure out why Hans would send them there. The more people you have there, the more chance there is that someone's going to screw up.
Right. I mean, I guess the maybe, you know, in case there's issue, if they need to get down to the lobby, they're only, you know, a floor or two away. Or maybe the thought is if, you know, if the police start coming up, they can kind of intercept. Now, he would be coming up in the elevator, you know, there'd have to be some way for them to stop the elevator before it gets all the way up. But maybe they're saying, you know, if the police get suspicious and they start coming up to the, you know, the 30th floor where the party is, they can intercept before, right. you know, before he gets there.
Well, if they're in the elevator, they can't.
Yeah.
only if they're walking, only if they're running up the stairs.
Yeah. I'm trying to think like how this makes
that's
sense.
That's great. You know, I was trying, I couldn't think of even that. So that's definitely helpful. And then they start speaking in German. And once again, I apologize to anyone who's listening who actually knows German. Forgive my accent of what he says. He said, one of them says to Alexander, "We will see this." And the question is, how many are there? And the response is, "Nor in mine, only a man." You know, trying to say, okay, you know, the fear. I think it's Fritz who says it. The fear is it okay? They have 100 cops there already. Now, mm-hmm. why would they have 100 cops? I'm not really sure. You know, it's not. You know, he's a little overly excited that there's so many police that theoretically could be there. And Alexander responds pretty calmly. You know, there's only one. Don't worry about it. And, you know, it's nice to see the four of them have this type of conversation. I mean, it's not a casual conversation, but they're just looking out at what's going on. You know, we're getting their perspective without Hans around mm-hmm. as to, you know, what do they think? And then the shot changes, and once again, we're back in the lobby, and Eddie walks by Powell, and he says, "We had that false alarm, you know. Ask me, that goddamn computer sent you out on another wild goose chase. They've been chasing bugs in this system ever since they installed it." So, first of all, I'm assuming you've heard of the term wild goose chase?
Yes.
Do you know that there is a technical term for that?
I did not know that.
The wild goose chase is a, I guess, informal mm-hmm. way or slang way of using it. It's called a snipe hunt.
Snipe hunt.
Yes. Which is a type of practical joke or fool's errand. Okay. There have been references to this phrase all the way back to the 1840s, in which an unsuspecting newcomer is duped into trying to catch a non-existent animal called a snipe. Although snipe are an actual family of birds, a snipe hunter is a quest for an imaginary creature whose description varies. Okay, the target of the prank is led to an outdoor spot and given instructions for catching the snipe. These often include waiting in the dark and holding an empty bag or making noises to attract the creature. The others involved in the prank then leave the newcomer alone in the woods to discover the joke. As an American rite of passage, snipe hunting is often associated with summer camp and groups such as the Boy Scouts. Okay, so it's interesting that this is the way. So a snipe hunt is a kind of fool's errand or wild goose chase, mm-hmm. meaning a fruitless errand or expedition. So that actually makes sense. It's, you know, just calling it a fruitless errand. That's interesting. And then there are so many different variations that I found of what a snipe hunt really is, but I'm not going to, you know, in different countries and stuff like that. In France, it's called hunting the dahut, and in Spain, it's called cazar gamusinos, which the gamusino is a imaginary animal creature. That's the idea here. So then part of the other things he says here is that, you know, they've been chasing bugs in the system. Okay, where do you think that term comes from? Bugs. We all know about it.
Yeah.
Anyone who works with computers, even on a non-professional level, has heard the terms computer bugs and things like that.
I think that's from an actual bug. I think, you know, in the early days before transistors and the miniaturization, computers were big things, and you'd have, you know, lots of wires, electronics, vacuum tubes, and so forth. And I think the origin of that is, you know, an actual bug in, you know, touching something electric, getting shocked, and causing a malfunction.
Okay. We'll see if that's correct. Yeah. So a software bug is an error, flaw, or fault in the design, development, or operation of a computer software that causes it to produce an incorrect or unexpected result, or to behave in unintended ways. The process of finding and correcting bugs is termed debugging, mm-hmm. and often uses formal techniques or tools to pinpoint bugs. Since the 1950s, some computer systems have been designed to deter, detect, or autocorrect various computer bugs during operations. Bugs in software can arise from mistakes and errors made in interpreting and extracting users' requirements, planning a program design, writing its source code, and from interaction with humans, hardware, and programs, such as operating system or libraries. A program with many or serious bugs is often described as buggy. Bugs can trigger errors that may have ripple effects. The effects of bugs may be subtle, such as unintended text formatting, through to more obvious effects such as causing a program to crash, freezing the computer, or causing damage to hardware. You have security bugs, sometimes sent by malicious users, and things like that. There are bugs that have been linked to various disasters. The Therac 25 radiation therapy machine, which was responsible for many deaths in the 1980s. It was bugs in the code that mm-hmm. That caused that problem. In 1996, the ESA's $1 billion prototype, the ESA is the European Space Agency's $1 billion prototype Ariane 5 rocket, was destroyed less than a minute after launch because they had a bug in the onboard guidance computer program. In 1994, there was a RAF helicopter that crashed, killing 29. That was originally blamed on pilot error, but later they figured out that there was a software bug in the engine control computer. In 2002, there was a study that was commissioned by the Department of Commerce that concluded that software bugs or errors are so prevalent and so detrimental that they cost the U.S. economy an estimated $59 billion on an annual basis.
Wow.
Which is 0.6% of the gross domestic product. Okay, the term bug that describes defects has been part of engineering jargon since the 1870s.
Okay, wow, so that goes back a long way.
And predates electronics and computers. It may have originally been used in hardware engineering to describe mechanical malfunctions. Thomas Edison apparently wrote in a letter in 1878, "Difficulties arise, gives out, and it is then the bugs, as such little faults and difficulties are, and they show themselves." Yeah, I guess so. I guess that must be just a urban legend that it was connected to a real bug.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly it goes back much further than I would have guessed.
So he's talking about the bugs. And I love the walk and talk that they do here. You know, yeah. The Eddie is going back to his post. Mm-hmm. You know, you think that maybe he's going to get closer to his gun or something like that.
But again, he's got to play it cool. He's got to be, you know, play the part of I'm just a regular security guard and there's nothing to see here, nothing out of the ordinary, nothing suspicious.
Right.
But even, you know, puts his feet up on the desk. He's totally relaxed.
And then we hear the sound of the TV and it says Notre Dame on top of USC. And he gets a little upset and Eddie goes, "Oh, shit. Yeah. Come on, I bet $50 of them. I got $50 bet on them."
Now, I wonder if part of this, you know, the kind of the script that Eddie's sticking to, if that's coming from Hans, if that's something he came up on to play on two things. One, there was the fire alarm that went off earlier, set off by John McClane, but that he was, you know, they were able to call that in and convince the fire department that was false alarm to kind of say,
right.
This is, you know, just
the code and that's it.
This, yeah. You know, this is another false alarm just like that was. And also kind of leverage the knowledge that they probably didn't tell, you know, they don't tell the patrolman a whole lot. They just say, there's a report, go check out this building because if, you know, this obviously doesn't fit because, you know, Al's there because of a call from a person, you know, someone speaking right on the phone saying, "Come out here." It's not, you know, that's not a, you know, that's not a, an issue with the building systems. That's not a,
exactly.
You know, that's not a computer issue. You know, that, you know, it, it, you know, that story doesn't check out at all. If, you know, if the, you know, if Al knows that he's there because of an actual phone call.
That's the thing. Al doesn't know.
But he doesn't know. He just knows he's there. And so.
Which is really silly that they, we discussed this earlier this week, that they didn't tell him why he's there.
Could have given him more information. But yeah, so kind of expecting, you know, they don't tell, you know, the patrolman, the workers, you know, the guy on the front line, they never give him all the information he needs to know. So you can play that, you can safely play this off as a, you know, as a, you know, a false alarm, something with the building systems, you know, blame it on the computer, basically.
Right. That's right. So tell me, what are you a fan of football at all? College football?
I am a fan of football, but pretty much just the pros. I don't watch college football much.
Okay. Have you ever heard of a college football game played on Christmas Eve?
So they're, you know, they're bowl games, you know, certainly like the regular season's over by this point, but they're bowl games, like, you know, around holidays, there's going to be Christmas Eve and Christmas Day games and, you know, and New Year's Day games. So it's, I mean, I don't know if there was an actual game on Christmas Eve or these teams played, you know, either in 87 when this would have been filming or in 88 when it came out, but, it's, you know, not entirely unusual that, that kind of two, you know, two big teams would be playing or, you know, around this time of year.
Okay. Well, first of all, the college football season, ends around Thanksgiving time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying it's about a month, and it's very rare that there is a college football bowl game played on Christmas Eve itself. It's played either on New Year's Day or Christmas Day. You know, most football games, those type of football games are played during the day, even on Thanksgiving. You have, you know, the games that
right.
are played during the thing. Now, the problem is that you don't have games of two teams that have met in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
So USC and Notre Dame would have played during the regular season, so therefore they wouldn't be in a special bowl game.
Right.
You know, the basically. And the John Hancock Sun Bowl, which played on December 24th, 1988... was between Alabama and Army.
Yeah.
And it wasn't between that. So, you know, I guess he's watching an old recording or something. You know, that he taped on you know, on a VHS.
Yeah.
Now, he says that he bet $50 on them. How much do you think $50 from 1987 or 1988 is worth today due to inflation?
I would guess say 150. Is it tripled in that time?
No, it has not. So in 1987, $50 from 1987 would be worth today $128.65, which is a cumulative rate of inflation of 157%.
Okay. In what, now, almost 35 years? About 35
that's,
years?
That's 35 years.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what's even more interesting is if you look at 1988, okay, it was worth $123.54, which means that inflation went down a year later.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, that if this takes place in 1988, it's worth $4 less, $5 less.
Wow.
That's a pretty big difference, you know, between 1 year.
That's, yeah.
$5 and going in the opposite direction.
Right,
you think with everything that goes that's going on nowadays, things only go up.
Things, yeah.
You know, it didn't go down because that was only in 1988, that's 147% cumulative rate of inflation as opposed to 157.
What a difference a year makes.
That's right.
Apparently.
I mean, also, he doesn't do it very convincingly. You know, the way that he looks upset about the fact that he bet money on them. Yeah. I've never believed the way that he delivers that line. You know, it sounds a little too fake. You know, damn, I bet $50 on those. Like it doesn't sound as if he really did by the way that he says it.
And that line always kind of struck me wrong, which is a little surprising because the false alarm, that damn computer sending you out on another wild goose chase.
Yeah.
That's all believable. Like I like, you know, those are all good deliveries.
But then the delivery of that particular line, because that's the fakest of everything, you know, that he really cares about this football game.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of makes me think of the Sting, the Robert Redford, mm-hmm. Paul Newman movie. At the end, you know, they're trying to hustle this gangster. They've set up a fake betting parlor, and you know, it, the whole, you know, they're you know, similar, you know, the comment about the, you know, this, he may be watching this game on tape. You know, that they're replaying, you know, races that have already been run, so they know the results, and they've got a bunch of con men like playing other customers in this betting parlor, and of course they've got to pretend, you know, that they've got money on, and you know, they're rooting for one horse or another, and like there's one of the particular con men who we're not, who like really has a bad delivery in terms of faking actual excitement, and it's that you know, this line makes me strike, you know, kind of hits me the same way in terms of,
right, because it just, yeah, doesn't seem,
it's
just,
it, yeah, it's not entirely believable, which it kind of makes sense Al wouldn't necessarily pick up on, because he doesn't know he's in a movie, you know, the character thinks this is a real thing,
and, right, and he also wants to go home, you know, like, yeah, he's waiting to go home now,
right, and he's, yeah, not, he's waiting for anything, he's, else. He's not looking for trouble, actually just the opposite, he's right. looking for any excuse to say, yeah, false alarm, nothing to see here,
I'm going home,
let me you know, take, you know, my Twinkies and go home, right,
exactly. And at this point, we get another shot from above. John's getting really impatient here by looking, and he goes, where's the f***ing cavalry? Come on, come on. And, you know, he's, you see him looking in both directions, trying to figure out, okay, what do I need to do in order for things to move along? You know, how can I change this situation to my advantage? You know, so that someone is going to do something here.
Yeah, well, and he sees, you know, he knows how long the police have been, or, you know, the policeman has been in the lobby, and figures at some point, like, if something doesn't happen soon, it's not going to happen.
Right, but it's possible that the cop inside is dead. I mean, he doesn't know anything.
Right, right.
You know, that's what's very funny here. Mm-hmm. You know, John wants to somehow get the policeman's attention. Okay, mm-hmm. fine. But the policeman's not there.
Right.
Is he dead? Is he alive? You know, what has happened to him on the inside? Is he sitting down watching the football game with Eddie? You know, yeah. there's so many different options of what could be going on here. The last thing that John needs to do here is, you know, he wants to get Al's attention, but
right.
he needs to wait until Al gets outside, and he doesn't. You know, he decides to, you know, he looks around the room, sees a chair, and decides, okay, this is my best option. I'm going to take it, and I'm going to smash the chair through the window.
Yeah.
Which isn't very bright. You know, I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know. Would you think that these must be very, it should be thick glass also.
Yeah, they generally don't want people, you know, falling out of windows on, you know,
in skyscrapers.
So these windows are going to be, the glass is going to be hard to break, and it's going to be hard even just, you know, try to force out the whole pane out of the window is, something that's going to be difficult. But, you know, kind of one of our options, I mean, what we see a lot of, and it's kind of a recurring theme in the whole film, is improvisation and kind of thinking on your feet. And certainly, you know, John McClane has not planned or expected any of this, you know, so right. he's got to think on his feet. But we see it from the other side, too, in terms of things don't go exactly the way Hans has planned them out. And he's right. got to adjust and think on his feet. And, you know, that's kind of what we see, like these, you know, these two characters going against each other, protagonist, antagonist, mm-hmm. and, you know, reacting to what each other does.
The great thing is they're both reacting spontaneously, like right. you said.
So kind of what are John McClane's options in this point? It's kind of, yeah, right. grab a chair and start swinging in terms right. of...
And I like the way that they show him look around the room.
Yeah.
And then, like, you can see, there are many times in this movie where you can see, like, a light bulb just, like, you know, open up above his head.
Yeah.
You know, and with Hans, it's never like that, because Hans does things in a calm, collective manner.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see him think of bright ideas of how to deal with things. You know, even a few weeks ago when we had the point where he decided to send Tony up to see, you know, about what level mm-hmm. John was on when he pulled the fire alarm.
Yeah.
You know, like, he stops mid-thought and then, you know, picks up the walkie-talkie and says, what floor was that? You know, it's a very different type of spontaneity. But right. there still is the spontaneity that, you know, the gears in his mind are working.
Yeah.
And they're moving along, you know, for that type of stuff.
Yeah, the more thoughtful versus the more impulsive.
Yeah, exactly. So then he takes the chair and smashes it against the window, and only one of the legs actually goes through the glass. You know, I wonder if it's because John doesn't have enough force. He's not strong enough. I don't know. Absolutely no clue as to why it's playing out that way.
Yeah. And cheap office furniture.
Yeah. And, well, you'd think that Nakatomi would have spent good money on it.
Well, yeah. Well, because this is kind of like the boardroom. I mean, this isn't, right. You know, the front end drones are sitting on in their cubicles. This is, correct. This should be the good stuff.
Right. And I mean, this is, you know, we already know that these are sturdy chairs because, you know, a body can fall backwards on the chair and the chair doesn't break.
Right.
You know, that would have been a little bit of comedy, you know, that Takagi, you know, gets shot in the head and then we see the chair just the chair like, breaks into apart. Pieces as he falls down. But no, it doesn't happen here. And then I love the fact that they show us an outside shot mm-hmm. of the chair. You know, the editing here is amazing, the way that they do this. You know, you see him pick up the chair and it goes towards the window. And as it's going towards the window, they switch the shot and you see the leg come out the other end mm-hmm. of the window. And then it pans up and we get to see James, who's on top of the, who's on the roof.
Yeah.
You know, he picks up the walkie-talkie and starts saying something.
Yeah. I mean, I admit often watching, you know, having seen this film many, many times, I still kind of, sometimes I'll get lost or confused in terms of, you know, which one of the terrorists is where everyone's in is, but
the guy with the ponytail is hard to miss.
Yeah. But, you know, but they certainly, they try to, you know, outline things and make it clear as much as they can. So I like this, that shot panning up from, you know, from John McClane in the window, panning up to the roof.
Right. Because also then we can see the distance from the 30th floor. We can see, this can't be the 30th floor. The boardroom isn't on the same floor as the hostages. So this, I think, is the 32nd
floor? Is it the 32nd?
I think it's the 32nd.
But we get an idea of how far they are from the roof. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if you look at the shot, you know, when it pans up, can you see how many floors it is? No. It's all pitch black.
It's a blur. It's dark.
And it's, I mean, even if you were to do it in slow motion, you wouldn't be able to see it because it's all black. Yeah. It's all very dark, the way that that they do that. And as James is giving his report, which we can't hear, so the minute ends.
The minute ends.
Is there anything else you want to say about this minute before we move on to the script?
Nope, that's everything I had for 55.
All right, so the script once again has some discrepancies from the final shot of the movie. So first of all, we see that Alexander, Eddie is a little startled, but he moves quickly. Alexander also hears this, and his eager expression fades, but orders are orders. Mm-hmm. You know, it's giving us a little bit more of an impression as to who this Alexander is, because we don't really get it. He doesn't do very much in the movie besides stand around.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't. So in the script, they make him, you know, he's itching for a fight, you know, that type of thing. And then it says the front door of Nakatomi. Powell tries the front doors. They are locked. Eddie comes hustling across and unlocks the door with the magnetic card. And then he has, you know, instead of him saying, what can I do for you? He says, what's up? He says, even an officer, what's up? And then it says, you know, Powell steps in and looks around. Bland holiday muzak filters from speakers. And we hear the song Let It Snow, which we know he's been humming for a while, you know. And then Powell says, we got an emergency call that there was a problem here. And at this point, McClane shows McClane on the 34th floor, which is where the boardroom is, according to the script. And McClane says, all right. McClane waits, expectant, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, but no commotion, no shouting. He frowns and says, where's the recovery? And then it shows again Powell walking through the lobby, and they have a little bit of a conversation, you know, between two of them about the bugs and the wild goose chase and stuff like that. And the only difference is that when Eddie talks about the $50, he says, "I got $50 bet on you, Alex." So he's talking to the TV, as opposed to talking to Powell.
To Powell, yeah.
Which, again, I think it works better that he's talking to Powell and says it to Powell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that he's showing Powell that, okay, everything is completely boring here.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to worry about anything. Nothing's going on here. I'm stuck here. I'm sitting and watching the game. Unfortunately, I spent $50 on them, and it looks like I'm going to be losing.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that's the extent of how that works. And then right afterwards, we have the line that we were talking about yesterday where McLean goes, come on, come on. Who's in that car? Stevie Wonder? So you see, it's in the script, but it's much later in the script where they have that. And then it says, he makes up his mind. He lifts one of the big chairs and swings it at the window. The tempered glass whitens on the first blow. And then it says, James sees the glass whiten and shouts into his mic. As opposed to shouting into his walkie-talkie and stuff like that. So that's pretty much how they end that here. Every Friday we have a surprise segment, which is only a surprise at this point for anyone who isn't paying attention on the Friday episode. Sorry, Sean. So the segment that we do is Weekend Surprise, which it's a known debate about Die Hard that some people claim that it is a Christmas movie, and some people claim that it is by far and wide not a Christmas movie. So what do you think? What's your opinion on it? Do you think it's a Christmas movie or not a Christmas movie? And, you know, don't forget that you have to, you know, show your answers.
So my work, support my argument. I think it absolutely is a Christmas film. I don't think there's any question. No doubt in my mind. I think it certainly occurs at Christmas. We've got various, features of the holiday that come into play. Most prominent, of course, the it all happens around an office Christmas party, which is, a setting for many Christmas films, or at least several. I think it, in its own way, it hits on the themes of, family and, appreciating your family and being thankful. I mean, it's a little bit of a different way, in handling that because for the most part, it's a man who's on his own, but it's through being alone that he learns to appreciate, gains a new appreciation for his family. It shows him, working for his family. I really don't think there's any question. I mean, I could just as easily say, would anyone argue that Home Alone is not a Christmas movie? And Home Alone is pretty much just Die Hard with a little kid in his own home versus an office building. But it's the same way. He's on his own the whole time. He gains new appreciation for his family when they're reunited at the end. That happens to that occurs at Christmas, but there's no reason it has to be. You could easily just say, the family was going away for a summer vacation instead of traveling for Christmas. And Home Alone can happen that way. But again, I don't think anyone would try to argue that Home Alone is not a Christmas movie.
Well, I would say that I'm assuming there are people that would argue it.
I guess there's all kinds out there.
There are people that are going to argue everything.
And the people that listen to podcasts, they're a crazy bunch. So who knows what they're going to say. But I think it's got, we've got the Christmas party. We've got Christmas trees. We've got the iconography. You've got the... I've got a machine gun now, ho, 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 kind of bringing the holiday aspect to it. Those are all sort of superficial in terms of kind of set and setting. It goes to, really a Christmas film. Does it have the Christmas themes? I think it does, the appreciation of gifts, the appreciation of family, of what you have, of being separated and trying to get back together again, all fit in and all make this not just a Christmas movie, but one of the better Christmas movies.
Okay, that's fair. That's great. So is there anything you want to discuss about the movie on a whole? I got to leave Boston soon. I've had enough. Yeah. I'm actually next week. I got to be in another city, so we'll be on location again next week. But I'll be on location. You can come if you want, but you have to get Kat's permission to come also. There.
Right, right.
But is there anything else you wanted to discuss about the movie in general?
No, I think we're getting it all out. You're covering it properly minute by minute. So I don't know if I have much to add other than just, I enjoy the film and I enjoy hearing the in-depth analysis that you and your guests bring to it. So this is all good.
Right. Okay, great. I'm very glad to hear that my reboot is working.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, great. So you want to, for one last time this week, tell people how they can get in touch with Sean German.
Yeah, so one last time, I am from the Next Scene Podcast. You can find that at nextscenepod.com. And I previously covered two films, minute by minute. So I covered Groundhog Day, 1 minute at a time at Groundhog Minute. And I covered This is Spinal Tap over at Spinal Tap Minute. And all my previous, my current, previous, and future podcast stuff is at catandsean.org.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, which is movierobminute.com. You can go find me on Twitter, or you can find me on Facebook. So everyone have a great weekend. Thank you once again, Sean, for... first of all, your hospitality of letting me stay in Boston for this week. And thank you for being such a great guest. Until Monday, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!